The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Char. On the show this week, it's easy to break a heart, but not so easy to mend one.
Our cells would migrate in, they responded to the wound, and they went to the right area. They were basically, as far as we were concerned, structurally and functionally coupled, which is really important.
We talked to Professor Paul Riley about his promising new work on repairing the cell damage caused by heart attacks. And
we now know that various types of bone marrow stem cell leak at very low levels into the bloodstream in all of the blood all of the time.
In a double bill of cutting-edge British research, Ian Sample finds a scientist who can repair nerve cells damaged by advanced multiple sclerosis. We also have this week's science news, including some dramatic claims that we've gone so far with climate change that we urgently need to work out ways of sucking greenhouse gases out of the air. And an eye-popping story about changes to the periodic table. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Fixing a broken heart is one of those things that novelists and songwriters would give anything to do, but it's now scientists who've beaten them to it. Scientists at University College London, funded by the British Heart Foundation, have shown that it's possible to induce the damaged hearts of mice to regenerate after a heart attack. The work was led by Professor Paul Riley, and he joins me now in the studio to tell me more. Welcome to the show, Paul. Now, before we start, why don't you tell us why it's so difficult to repair the heart?
Well, good morning and thank you for the invitation. It's been a significant problem for a number of years that many investigators have tried to tackle in various forms. That the bottom line is that the adult human heart, and in fact the adult mammalian heart, can't repair itself. If you have a heart attack, progression to heart failure occurs because the heart scars, doesn't replace the muscle that's lost, doesn't replace the damaged blood vessels. And until a few years ago, it was thought that the heart was fairly dormant or a terminally sort of differentiated organ. It couldn't really respond in any way to add cells for repair or even just basic replenishment. And there have been a number of studies actually trying to look very carefully at whether the heart can turn over cells, etc., because that's obviously important to try and trigger that for then repairing following injury. I mean, there's a great study on carbon-14 dating from nuclear fallout through the Cold War testing of nuclear arms, and people have naturally taken up radioactive carbon, and that actually then labels the cells, and in fact they did show a very, very slow turnover of cells in the adult heart in humans. And so that was a nice indication sort of a few years ago now. It's a major problem. Trying to find some means of enabling the heart to repair itself is a huge medical problem.
So where do you start? I mean, if your textbooks say that it's not possible, wouldn't you just sort of close the book and do something else?
Well, that's right. I mean, I think that the issue for us was that we really concentrated on the developing heart and how the heart is built in the embryo during pregnancy, and our sort of point was really looking carefully at different cells during that process, cells that could make blood vessels and make muscle or contribute to the muscle during development. And the fact that there is an equivalent set of cells in the adult heart gave us some hope that we might be able to stimulate that embryonic potential in the adult.
So the cells you looked at were on the outside of the developing heart in the embryo. What do these do in the embryo?
So these cells are called epicardial cells, and in the embryo they form from a little proepicardial organ which sits at the inflow region of the developing heart. These cells then migrate, they cover the outside of the heart as it develops, they then move inward and they form the coronary blood vessels, the blood vessels that will supply the heart and the nutrients and the oxygen required during its growth and function. And also they've been shown in a couple of papers by Nature back in 2008 also to form and contribute a proportion of the muscle. So in that respect, they're a key population of cells during development for the formation of the heart.
And you were trying to sort of regress, and they do exist in adults, they still sit there on the outside, but they don't do anything in terms of the sort of the usual regrowing bits.
Well, that's right. The issue here was that these cells are still there and they have come from this embryological source and they're sitting around the outside of the adult heart. The problem that we encountered and others have observed is that they're not really doing a great deal, as you say. So we can show that they can respond a little bit to injury, but they don't do enough to sort of bring back this, if you like, turn back the clock to recapture the embryonic side of things, i.e. making new cell types.
And so that was your lead. How did you start to investigate what would restart this process of regeneration from these cells?
Well, again, it came from studies in the developing heart. So we were keen to look at how the heart forms, how the different cell types involved, etc., and even how, you know, it morphologically changes during its development. So we did a study in mice where we targeted a gene called thymosin beta-4, which we pulled out of an earlier screen. And this gene is very important for cell-based motility. It binds actin and et cetera. It's also been shown to change gene expression by getting into the nucleus. So this protein was quite of interest to us. It's expressed in the heart in the right places. And we targeted it, so we created a mouse that had lost the function of this gene. And in fact, what we saw was that the heart stopped developing sort of partway through pregnancy, and the coronary blood vessels were really deficient. And in fact, the exact cell type that was the problem was these epicardial cells. So that's how we got a clue that thymosin beta-4 was essential for this epicardial-derived coronary blood vessel formation. Therefore, we took a huge leap of faith and thought, well, might it be sufficient if we add it back to adult cells to recapture this potential?
And it worked.
It did, and it was definitely one of those sort of eureka moments. I mean, we weren't sure. I mean, we had no idea if it was going to be capable of doing that. And we did it in a very simple assay system, which involves sort of taking small pieces of adult mouse hearts with epicardial cells on them, putting them in dishes, adding thymosin beta-4, and seeing if we could literally get any response. Because if you don't add anything at all, or just some kind of vehicle control, they just sit there as little pieces of tissue, nothing happens. Add back thymosin beta-4, and these cells migrate, they proliferate, they expand in number, and we could track all of the cell types. And in particular, at this point in time, we were looking for the blood vessel cell types, and we found smooth muscle cells, some endothelial cells, which make up the vessels themselves, and also fibroblasts, which kind of form the skeleton of the heart as it develops.
And so this is interesting. In the experiment itself, you gave mice this protein beforehand, then the mice suffered heart attacks, and then afterwards you gave them more of this protein and found that the damage that the heart attacks caused, the scarring and these problems that you talked about earlier, that some of that was reversed. What scale of fixing happened?
Right, the important point was the pre-treatment, if you like, of the mouse before we invoked a heart attack. So we needed to build on this kind of idea of reactivation. So we need to get these cells primed, as we called it, which was basically switch on an embryonic gene program in these adult cells prior to them being able to respond.
Make them think they're back in the embryo.
That's exactly right. Turning back the clock, letting them think that they're back in the embryo, actually contributing to building the heart. And so here we are, we've got these cells, they're activated. And what we did observe, and we held our hands up about, was the fact that there weren't many of these activated cells that became heart muscle cells. So we firmly believe that there's a number of different effects from thymosin beta-4 and from activation. One is this coronary blood vessel effect. One is the new muscle, and also there are other issues with inflammation and anti-inflammation, etc., that thymosin beta-4 is known to do. So there's a number of different things contributing. One of the key points was that despite the relatively small number of new heart muscle cells, we did observe significant increases in functional parameters that were beneficial for the animals. And we did some really nice studies with Mark Lithgow's group at UCL, and we did MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, of hearts over a time period of treated and untreated. And key parameters like the ability of the heart to eject blood was improved by 25%.
And another important thing is that did these cells, I mean, assuming these cells, when they were produced, they migrated into the heart and functioned properly. They didn't beat at different rhythms or something.
Absolutely right. And in fact, that's a key point. So previous studies, we're not the first to say that there are cells in the heart residing in the adult heart that could have some potential to contribute new cell types. But what we found was our cells would migrate in, they responded to the wound and signals from the wound, they went to the right area, the area of damage, they congregated around that area, they structurally coupled together and with existing heart muscle that has survived the injury, and they were able to functionally couple, which means that they could transmit calcium gradients to contract. So they were basically, as far as we were concerned, structurally and functionally coupled, which is really important.
And what would a treatment look like? What might this result in? Is it going to be, people when they think of stem cell-like treatments, they think of injections and gene therapy and all sorts of things. What would a treatment based on your research look like?
Okay, well, the first thing to say is that we're actually moving this into humans as we speak. So we did all these studies in mouse, as you rightly said, and we're taking the human equivalent cells, these human epicardial cells from biopsies taken from the UCL Heart Hospital with clinical colleagues over there, and we're able to look in culture again at the effect of thymosin beta 4 and other molecules. So we can start screening a number of compounds, and hopefully we will see an effect on producing muscle or producing blood vessels. A treatment, well, I mean, it's purely speculation at this time, but the way that the study worked was we had to prime, so it would almost have to be a slightly preemptive treatment. We would foresee something like an oral tablet or oral medication for ease of delivery that would be specifically activating these cells. And so the issue here is we'd have to get at patients potentially before the actual heart attack. So there are two kind of populations there. One is the sort of at-risk individuals who we already know because they've gone into their GP surgery, had one of those MOTs, their cholesterol levels are high, their blood pressure's high, they've potentially got hypertension, coronary angina, etc. And if they've got a strong family history, we could sort of target them as a population. The other ones are people who present at hospital with chest pain and breathlessness, who might have a history of coronary angina, who potentially are heading down the road to a heart attack within minutes, within hours, etc. And that's a window of opportunity for treatment pre the actual injury event. So we would envisage, although this is some way off yet, that if we can translate this to the human cells, which we're doing, if we can screen for effective drugs against these cells and identify something, then it would be hopefully some kind of preemptive oral medicine for priming.
And just finally, when you say some way away, how long? And that's always the million-dollar question, isn't it?
It is, but it's an important question, and obviously there'll be many people out there who want to know the answer. History tells us that if you go from a basic research finding to a registered and clinically approved drug, it takes about 20 years. Now, we wouldn't say it would necessarily take that long, so we would say probably a conservative decade, but I get back to the point about the screening with known drugs. If we find a known drug out there that can stimulate these cells, that's already gone through trials, already safe and approved, then that could bring this significantly forward.
Paul, thank you very much.
No, thank you.
It's been a busy week in science news, so joining me to round up this week's big stories, I've got Fiona Harvey, the Guardian's environment correspondent, and Ian Sample, our reliable science correspondent. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hi, Alec.
Ian, let's start with you, actually. So you've had a chat to some guys at Fermilab, and, you know, is there a new particle in the offing?
Well, let's give some background. I mean, in the past few months, there's been quite a lot of excitement in certain areas, it has to be said, of the physics community, the particle physics community, because there's an American collider known as Tevatron, and that has two detectors on it, two detector teams. And one of those teams in April came out with some results which suggested they had seen tentative evidence for an unknown particle. Now, what would be quite interesting about it is that particle could mean a number of things if it was real, but one of those things might be evidence for a new force in nature, or it could be support for a theory known as supersymmetry, which suggests that every type of particle we know about has a kind of a heavy twin. Now, that was taken quite sort of tentatively at first, but in June there was an update from the group. They'd looked at more data and the signal actually got stronger. So the evidence had gone up to the point where the chance of it being a fluke was about 1 in 1,000,000. Now, sort of before digging into the champagne, people were waiting for an independent cross-check from this second group on the Tevatron Collider known as D0. And late last week, on Friday, they came up with their analysis. Basically, they looked through all of their data and tried to see if they could find the same particle. And the sad news is that they saw nothing. And this essentially nails that as a potential discovery. It basically sinks it. And it's a shame because although there are other things that look interesting at Tevatron, they may come up with a discovery. This collider is closing down at the end of the year, actually probably September, October, and this would have been a really nice last hurrah for them.
I mean, Tevatron, as you say, has been sort of racing in the last few years to try and get these new bits of physics, or at least some, before it sort of hands over to the Large Hadron Collider. Is there any chance then, in the next how many months it's got left, 3 or 4 months it's got left, that any of these big physics things are going to come out of it?
Well, this is the million-dollar question. There are two conferences, two major conferences in the summer, July and August. And the teams will be taking their latest data to those, and they won't actually be doing analyses for certain things until the sort of days before those conferences. So there may still be stuff that comes out of the woodwork. There are some intriguing signals that are still being looked at Tevatron that might be signs of something really interesting, but whether they'll actually have enough to say that's conclusive at any of those conferences is up in the air at the moment. I'd say it's there's still a chance, but it's getting slimmer.
Okay, well, we'll move from the smallest thing in the world to the whole world itself. Fiona, you wrote a story last week about sort of even more dire straits coming out from the UN climate chief. There's some talks going on in Bonn, and she was talking about having to now suck CO2 and other greenhouse gases from the air. Has it got that desperate?
Well, it's getting increasingly desperate. We had some news from the International Energy Agency last week, of course, showing that there was the biggest rise ever in greenhouse gases last year. And, you know, where we should have been slowing down the rate of greenhouse gas production, we're actually going in the opposite direction. We're speeding up. So this is a very big problem, obviously, and governments are meeting this week in Bonn to talk about the forming a new global treaty on climate change. But, you know, there isn't much progress to report, I'm afraid.
It's a familiar story, this, isn't it? Yeah. It goes on and on. I mean, at the end of Copenhagen a couple of years ago, even before then, it was, well, we need to reduce this and we need to try and come up with a treaty and everything. But they weren't talking about drastic measures like, you know, actually having technologies to suck CO2 out of the atmosphere. It was all about then restricting your own emissions. So what's changed in that time that, I mean, you mentioned the increase, of course, from the IEA report, but is it posturing by the climate scientists at the UN to say, well, you know, it's got terrible, we need to start thinking about investing in adaptation and mitigation technologies, essentially?
There's already a lot of effort going into adaptation, and that's one of the key parts of the negotiations, because, you know, there is going to be a certain amount of warming, we know that. The hope is to hold the warming to 2 degrees, but even at 2 degrees of warming, there is an awful lot of damage that will be done in vulnerable areas. That's one of the reasons why the UN climate chief, Christiana Figueres, has suggested that we should be going for, you know, no more than 1.5 degrees of warming. Now, that's a very politically difficult thing to do, because, you know, the negotiations are really predicated at this point upon holding things to 2 degrees. But if we're going to do that, if we're going to have 2 degrees of warming, then we have to prepare for that. And that's going to mean preparing for sea level rises, preparing for areas of the globe becoming unsuitable to agriculture, preparing for stronger storms, for droughts, heat waves, floods and so on.
And all of that is inherent in the 2 degrees C rise by the end of the century anyway. I mean, this is all stuff that's latent in the system. At the moment, the talks going on in Bonn, how do they fit into the sort of this cycle of talks that the UN has about climate change? I mean, there's a big conference coming up at the end of the year in South Africa, which is a sort of two successes on from Copenhagen,
that's,
I suppose.
Right.
So what are all the talks in between? The one in Bonn, for example, is it a staging conference for that?
Yes, essentially that's what it is. It will set out, you know, some of the procedures before the Durban conference. I mean, these conferences happen every year. under the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change from the early 90s, every year in December, usually late November, there's a conference to kind of update on where we are on progress and so on. And so before that, there has to be, it's usually in Bonn every June, a conference that sort of, you know, sets the scene. It's where the sort of the officials, the civil servants and people like that, and technical experts go to thrash out some of the ideas. And then at the conference at the end of the year, then the ministers arrive and they do the kind of political side of the negotiations. So it's a hugely complex process. It's very slow, but, you know, you've got all of the world's governments taking part, so inevitably it's going to be slow.
Why aren't you there? You should be there, surely.
Because it's not interesting enough.
Okay.
Not enough is happening.
We have it.
Yeah, sadly, not enough is happening at the moment. And there's an awful lot of criticism, actually, of the South African hosts, I have to say, because they are in charge of trying to make the conference in Durban a success, which would mean, you know, actually making some progress on things like financing from developed to developing countries, to do some of the things that we were talking about in terms of adaptation and so on. And in order to get to that end result, you need to do an awful lot of diplomacy behind the scenes. You need to have an awful lot of sort of meetings along the way before you get to this big meeting at the end. And South Africans have been criticised for not doing that. There's a feeling that they haven't shown the degree of commitment to pushing forward the process that really they could have. And we don't have details on things like, you know, a schedule of other meetings to sort out some of these very complex technical details that do need to be sorted out, because otherwise, if they're not sorted out in advance, you get scenes like we saw at Copenhagen, where, you know, the negotiations start to fall apart because the preparation hasn't been done.
Well, let's wind up with a question for you both, Fiona and Ian. There's two new elements added to the periodic table, elements 114 and 116. We need some names for these elements, and I think the listeners are going to hopefully send in some suggestions. But given your eminent status, if you like, maybe you can suggest some. Have you got any thoughts, Ian? You're a particle physics man. They must be coming up with all sorts of partons and gluons and all sorts of things. Have you got a name? Who needs to be remembered?
I can name one of them.
Go on.
Okay, so I don't really care which one it is, but it should be called Vonnegutium.
Very good.
Because you should know that Kurt Vonnegut was had a chemistry, studied chemistry at Cornell, and he doesn't have, well, he's dead now, but it'd be nice sort of to posthumously award him an element, I think.
That's
very good.
That would
be pretty cool.
That's very good. Fiona, have you got any, maybe some climate scientists, environmentalists, who needs to be remembered for the forever?
Well, I thought that as it's a very, very heavy element,
oh, no.
Maybe we should call it obesium.
But, this could go on.
But also, you know, I mean, well, as it's his birthday at the moment, surely Bob Dylanium.
That's good. Bob Dylan or Kurt Vonnegut. Well, there's a definite arts bent here. Thanks to you both. Ian's going to stay with me for the next story as well. But if you want to read more from Fiona, go to guardian.co.uk/environment. So Ian, you've stayed with us to tell us about your chat with another pioneer of regenerative medicine. You might have heard about regrowing hearts before. Now we're going to talk about regrowing nerve cells. Tell us more.
Well, this is a bit of research by a guy called Neil Scolding at Bristol University. And what he's doing essentially is using stem cells to try and regenerate damaged nerve cells in the spinal cord and the brain that are suffered by multiple sclerosis patients. Now, he has recently won or been given a donation of more than $1 million to carry out the second stage of this research. He's already done a small pilot study, and I spoke to him about this second stage of research, and I asked him what that was all about.
Well, we know a great deal more about bone marrow stem cells over the last couple of years than we've known for a long time. Our understanding of what they do has changed very substantially. And we now know that various types of bone marrow stem cell leak, as it were, at very low levels into the bloodstream in all of us all of the time. When an organ is damaged, whether it's the brain or the spinal cord or the skin or the liver, Two things happen. First of all, more of those stem cells are released into the bloodstream. And then second, the area of damage, again, whether it's in the brain or the liver or skin or whatever, expresses various signals that attract and pull in those different types of stem cell from the bloodstream so that they then get into the area of damage. And once they do that, they can trigger repair or contribute to repair, actually using a variety of different mechanisms. So it's kind of a one of the ways that the body helps to limit disease and limit and reverse damage. What we're trying to do with this form of therapy is to piggyback or exploit that process. So in a rather coarse approach, if you like, we take a very large sample of bone marrow from the patient, from the pelvic girdle as a rule. That needs to be done under a general anaesthetic. And essentially we do very little to that bone marrow. We clean it up, but very little else. And then re-inject this kind of mixture of different populations of bone marrow cells. We re-inject those cells back into the bloodstream. And that achieves levels of these cells in the bloodstream that are thousands, millions of times greater than would ordinarily be the case. And the hope, if you like, is that by having far more stem cells in the circulation, we will end up with more stem cells in the area of tissue damage, in particular in this instance, obviously, in the brain or the spinal cord. And if there are more cells there, then you will get more repair.
What stage is the research at now? There's been some early work already in humans, right?
That's right. So over the last 3 or 4 years, we've completed a small pilot study, if you like, to prove, first of all, that this is feasible and to prove, secondly, that it's safe. And those have to be the first things that you prove with any new form of therapy. So we treated 6 patients with long-standing multiple sclerosis using their own bone marrow cells. So we're working very closely with our hematology colleagues in the bone marrow transplant unit in Bristol. And giving them each patient his own or her own cells back, and then following them very closely, not least, as I say, looking for evidence that it might not be safe, following these people up very closely for 12 months. That's completed now, and not surprisingly, but still importantly, we showed that it was feasible and it was safe. None of the patients had any serious problems related to the transplant. And then we also looked, of course, at how they got on. And in particular, we looked at a number of electrical tests that measure nerve conduction in the brain and in the spinal cord. And we found that in all of these patients, there was an improvement, a statistically significant improvement in conduction in these nerve pathways that strongly suggest that these cells are indeed getting into the brain or the spinal cord as we'd hoped and as we'd predicted, and that they are having something of a useful effect once they're in there. And that result has been sufficient to encourage us that it's important to carry on with a larger study, which is what we now hope and aim to do.
You've had this very recent donation, which sounds as if it's going to allow you to do that further work. Tell us about that, and what will happen in that next phase of research?
This is a large donation, as you say, well over $1 million, from an American benefactor foundation who have been interested in funding multiple sclerosis research and have funded quite a lot of research in the United States. I think I'm right in saying that this is the first time they've funded research outside the US. And that will allow us to get the next clinical trial, phase 2 clinical trial, underway. And we hope that that will start towards the end of this year. That will differ from the phase 1 study in being much larger. So this will be 80 patients. And it'll be a controlled study. So we will actually compare treatment with these cells in 40 patients with a second group of 40 patients who are untreated. And then the second group will also receive the treatment at a later stage.
Can you say what the stem cells might be repairing? Are they repairing these kind of myelin sheaths around nerves, or is it something else going on in there?
It's a very good question and a very hard question to answer, because the only way of being certain what they achieve would be to look at the brain and the spinal cord under a microscope in the patients who've had treatment, which of course isn't feasible. From the experimental work that's been done, we know that these cells can trigger and contribute to repair in a number of different ways. So the brain itself has a certain capacity to repair myelin, but we know that these cells can actually enhance that effect, can stimulate the brain's own repair strategy. In addition, these cells can secrete a number of different factors that help to protect nerve cells from different types of damage. And then a third thing that they can do is to suppress inflammation and control inflammatory damage. So there are at least three, and in fact probably more, very different mechanisms that these cells can call upon. And a large part of the research that we're conducting in parallel with the next clinical trial will be to try and establish precisely which are the most important mechanisms in order that we can then go on in the future to enhance and improve the therapy.
So when is that next trial due to begin, and whereabouts will it be, and actually how long do you think it may be before you have any sort of meaningful results from it?
Yeah, well, we need to get all of the regulatory permissions and so on in place first, of course, and those are in the pipeline. Assuming those are secured, then we would hope to start recruiting to this study towards the end of this calendar year. It'll take probably about 2.5 to 3 years to complete the trial and get the results from that. And then we'll see where we are then. Obviously, it very much depends on the results.
Thanks to Professor Neil Scolding there, talking to The Guardian's Ian Sample. That's all we have for this episode of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time, of course, on theguardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Char, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye. See you next week for more.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.